When Cobb checked the water level at the new pumps the Erickson brothers had installed, he found that it had fallen by an inch and a quarter, and it was then that he decided to seek nomination as a member of the Water Commission. A second Texan to become personally aware of the big shifts underway lived at the opposite end of the state. Gabe Klinowitz, the real estate operator who had sponsored Todd Morrison when the latter drifted down from Detroit, was immensely informed concerning land values. His last big venture had been with a group of seven Mexican political figures to invest the massive funds they controlled. They had stunned him with the magnitude of what they wanted to do. But in obedience to their orders, he had quietly assembled the costly land and then watched as they spent $170 million on the Ramparts, an interlocking series of the finest condominiums in Houston. Irritated by this brazen display of wealth by citizens of a nation which sent a constant stream of near-starving peasants into Texas for food and jobs, Gabe consulted with a University of Houston professor who specialized in Latin American finances. "Tell me, Dr. Chagrin, how do these people get hold of so much money?" "Quite simple. They've learned how to outsmart our New York bankers." "You lose me. Don't apologize. Took me 2 years to unravel the intricacies." And with that, he spread upon his desk a series of figures so improbable that they perplexed even Klinowitz, who was accustomed to the chicaneries of mankind. "From impeccable United States government sources, I find that our big banks have loaned the Latin countries to the South $300 billion. And from equally reliable sources in the recipient countries, I find that clever politicians and business magicians have diverted $100 billion into either secret Swiss accounts or business ventures here in the U.S. Would you care to give me a synonym for that word, diverted? How about legally embezzled, or cleverly sequestered, or good old-fashioned stole?" He laughed. "Whichever you elect, the result's the same. The money we loaned them is no longer in the country where we hoped it would serve a constructive purpose." "The original loans, will they ever be repaid?" "I don't see how they can be, with the money vanished from the countries. I see no way that the Mexican government can recover the money your group has wasted here in Houston." "Have you the figures for Mexico?" "I haven't assembled the accurate figure for the total loans, but I can prove that in 1980 they borrowed $16 billion from us and allowed their manipulators to siphon off more than $7 billion of our dollars into their private accounts." "As an American taxpayer," Gabe said, "I'd like to know what happens if the original loans go sour." "You guessed it. One way or another, you'll pay." Gabe frowned. "If the American money had been kept in Mexico, could it have forestalled the poverty we see?" "Now you touch a very sore point, Mr. Klinowitz. From the very beginning, Mexico was always much richer than Texas. Anything we did for our people, they could have done for theirs." "What went wrong?" "I use the word diverted. It avoids moral judgment." So Klinowitz was not surprised when the peso, its backup funds having been so callously diverted, began to stagger. 36 to the dollar one day, 93 the next, 147 later, then 193, with a threat of further plunging. He was prepared and almost gleeful when the Mexican politicians flashed the distress signal. "For the time being, halt all construction." But he was a professional real estate man and was actually relieved when the Mexicans rounded up some additional capital and resumed building. For as he told Maggie Morrison, "I have pains in my stomach when a client of mine runs into trouble." However, he was shrewd enough to add, "If I were you, Maggie, I'd keep my eye on those three towers of the ramparts." "I'm no rental agency," she protested. "That's a heartache business." "I don't mean rentals. I've learned that if a building falls into trouble once, it'll do so again." "What could I do for the ramparts people?" "Maggie, how I wish I was 30 years old with a small nest egg. In a fluctuating market like this, a daring trader can perform miracles. I don't depend on miracles, she said cautiously. Real money is made in a falling market. Look at the unrented space in this city. And when she did, she perceived two startling facts. The sharp decline in oil values had caused the bankruptcy of many smaller firms servicing that industry, and this meant that space, which should have been rented for offices, stood idle. When she toted up the appalling figures, she found that 32 million square feet of the finest office space in America stood vacant in Houston. But what alarmed her more, with the rich Mexicans unable to visit the United States because of the disastrous devaluation of their peso, some 12 or 13 major Houston hotels were suffering from lack of business. Fine establishments, accustomed to 70% and 80% occupancy, were getting no more than 20 or 30, so that those which had depended on the Mexican trade were shutting down for the time being, while others were going on to a 5-day week to staunch the hemorrhaging. Every intuition she had acquired in Michigan warned Maggie to retrench. Every lesson she had learned from wise old Texans like Gabe Klinowitz urged her to make bold moves. In this impasse, she would have liked to consult with her husband, but he was preoccupied with other ventures. So, taking counsel only with herself, she monitored the chaos that seemed to have struck Houston business. But always, at the end of day, she drove past the ramparts to check on what the 7 Mexican politicians were doing with their beautiful chain of buildings. And every sign she saw whispered confidentially, "Gabe was right. These Mexicans are in deep trouble." The precipitous fall in the peso endangered more than the Mexican politicians, because all along the border, from Brownsville to El Paso, the Rio Grande bridges that once had brought thousands of brown-skinned people into American shops, where cameras, fine clothes, stereos, and perfume were sold at bargain prices unattainable in Mexico itself, were strangely empty. The devalued peso bought nothing. For 3 painful days, the Bravo Escandon Bridge, so long the scene of Mexican inflow, had no visitors from the south. And then the activity resumed, but in an ugly way that brought shame to the United States. American citizens streamed into Mexico to buy at bargain prices all the gasoline, baby food, vegetables, and beef the Mexican markets provided. For if the peso was down, the dollar had to be up. The drain of essentials continued. "The Norteamericanos are stealing us into starvation," came the justified cry from south of the border. And it was in this crisis period that feisty Simón Garza, now the mayor of Bravo, as a result of the revolution in voting patterns following the disturbances in the 1960s, projected himself into prominence. By the simple, illegal device of stationing his policemen at the Bravo end of the International Bridge and forbidding its citizens from going into Mexico to buy what were bargains for them but subsistence for the Mexicans, he attracted statewide approval. "We do not profit from the despair of others," he announced repeatedly. And he said this with such force that even those who had been depriving Mexico of its foodstuffs and means of movement applauded. Belatedly, the Mexican government placed an embargo on its dwindling supplies of food, and the situation righted itself, with the peso at the shocking black market rate of 193 to the dollar. But now Mayor Garza was confronted by his own problems, for with the absolute cessation of Mexican traffic into the town, the Bravo stores began to close down, as they were doing all along the Rio Grande. Seeking guidance as to what he must do to halt the strangulation of his community, he attended a meeting of the Valley Mayors in Laredo. And in that city, he saw real panic, because fully 40% of the luxurious emporiums were boarded up. Their business had not declined, it had vanished. There was no escape but the immediate firing of all employees and the barring of doors. If one had ever needed proof of the symbiotic relationship between northern Mexico and southern Texas, it was provided now. Because each side of the river, deprived in its own way, staggered toward economic breakdown. Unemployment on the American side rose to 20, then to 40%, and a movement was started to have the region declared a disaster area. Among all the leaders on both sides of the river, one man stood out for the coolness with which he handled the catastrophe and the steps he took to alleviate it. Simón Garza had been reared in a rugged school, fighting the remnants of the Horace Vigil dynasty, combating the Texas Rangers who had been determined to keep that dynasty in operation, and insisting that his fellow Hispanics go to college and learn the tricks of American life. Eat tortillas at home, speak Spanish in your games, but learn who Adam Smith and Milton Friedman are. In this drive toward educating his constituents, he was assisted by his brother Efrain, the professor at A&M, who uncovered scholarships at all the Texas universities to which bright girls and boys from Bravo could apply. "The revolution of the mind," the Garza brothers cried repeatedly. "That's what we must engineer." It was Simón who persuaded President Reagan, by means of a hard, non-hysterical telegram to the White House, to come down to the valley to see for himself the devastation wrought by the drop in the peso. And as he led the well-intentioned president past the empty bridge and the boarded-up stores, he was photographed with Reagan time and again, so that when the summary meeting was held in Laredo, the northern reporters, to whom conditions along the Rio Grande were a mystery, suddenly discovered that in Simón Garza, Texas had a Hispanic politician who made sense and who used most cleverly the perquisites of his office. Considerable attention was paid to the grateful statement of the Escandón mayor, who told the reporters in Spanish, "Garza, he knew what to do. He closed the bridge to keep us from starving." People would remember this. In his modest offices in Fort Worth, Ransom Rusk was facing such an assault from all sides that he groaned, "God must be mad at Texas." And while he was trying to sort things out, he received a preemptive call from his bank in Midland. "Better come down here and give us help." So, in his private plane, he flew to the Midland-Odessa airport, linchpin in the Texas oil complex, where he was met by the three managers of his service companies, who reported unanimous ruination for anything connected with oil. "Mr. Rusk, activated mud can find no customers at all. I think we'll have to fire everybody." Electronic logging was a little better, for it showed a 92% decline. But it was when he drove to the vast parking area between the two oil towns that he found visual proof of what had happened to the Bonanza region. For there, stacked neatly in rows like dinosaurs whose time had passed, stood, rusting in the bright sunlight, 19 of the 23 giant drilling rigs that would normally have been standing proudly erect in fields scattered across the landscape, from the Gulf to New Mexico. Now their towers lay prostrate, their drilling engines silent and gathering dust. "What did we pay for that last batch?" Rusk asked, and when his drilling manager said, "Special electronics, special everything, $13 million each." Instantly calculating 13 times 19, Rusk said quietly, "That's $247 million down the drain." He had multiplied 13 by 20 and subtracted 13. "Not completely lost," the manager assured him. "If oil comes back, which it will have to." "What could you get for this right now?" Rusk asked, kicking one of the rigs. "Maybe $150,000, if we could find a buyer." "That's 1% of its value. I call that loss." And in that sickening moment by the fallen rigs, there among the dinosaurs whose days of rampaging were gone, Rusk had to make his decision. A powerfully organized man just entering his 60s, he should have been free to enjoy his favorable position in the world, his power and his $1 billion. Instead, he found himself attacked on all sides, with foundations crumbling. But he did not propose to go down whimpering. He would fight back with all the energy he had been acquiring through past decades. He would ride out this storm, husband his resources, and prepare to fight back when conditions were more favorable. "Close down activated mud. Just close it down. We'll find something for the top people to do till oil recovers." Electronic logging? It's got to be of permanent value. What do you suggest? It was agreed that logging services would always be required, so long as one man wildcatted anywhere in Texas. Mr. Rusk, I think we should retain a core of the real experts, no matter. I think so, too. Cut to the bone and hunker down. And these? Almost lovingly, he touched with the toe of his cowboy boot the nearest prostrate rig. What in the world do we do with these? The question was almost academic, for it had no sensible solution. There lay the mighty rigs, their towering superstructures humbled. And unless prospecting for oil resumed, they would not rise again. They would be valueless. When none of his advisers offered a sensible solution, Rusk cut the Gordian knot. Fan out across Texas. Find young men who are willing to take a risk. Sell off these 19 idle rigs for whatever they'll bring, but get rid of them. We'll keep the 4 that are working, for when things start up again. You mean sell them regardless of what we can get? Exactly what I mean. The gamble for oil passes into younger hands. Mr. Rusk, I want your firm order on this. You're willing to sell this $13 million rig for $150,000? For $100,000, if that's what it brings. With that harsh decision behind him, he drove into Midland, where the managers of the bank in which he was heavily invested were in quiet panic. Ransom, the bottom is dropping out. It's all quicksand. Just how bad? And they explained what he had already suspected. If you drove in from the airport, you saw the service fields lying idle, your own among them. Did you notice the string of motels? 2 years ago, they had to limit guests to 3 nights in a row. Everybody wanted to come to Odessa to get in on the action. I noticed the few cars parked outside. Paul here owns 3 of them. 8% occupancy. Foreclosures everywhere. Rusk looked at Paul Mesmer, the distressed motel owner, and swore that under no circumstances would he, Rusk, allow himself to look like that. Firmly, he asked, "What's the worst aspect of our situation?" And he listened, in a shock he did not betray, as these good men, who had expected oil to go to $60 a barrel, explained what they faced when it dropped to 27. Bluntly, "That's the way I want it, bluntly. We may have to close our doors." "How much?" $1.25 billion. "That's a manly sum. Depositors protected?" "In part." "Us investors?" "A complete wipeout." Rusk heard this doleful news without wincing. He had $16 million in bank shares, and to lose it, on top of his heavy losses in the oil business, would be inconvenient but not disabling. Still, he hated to admit that his business judgment had been faulty, so he asked, "Any way we can prevent the feds from moving in?" "If we all chipped in more of our own money." "How much do you want from me?" "If you could see your way clear, $5 million? "Done." "Before you sign anything, Ransom, you realize that whatever you give will be in jeopardy." He did not answer the question. Instead, he looked at the embattled directors, these sturdy men of the plains who had gambled fantastically, making it big when things went their way, now willing to put up small fortunes when things turned sour. Instead, he looked at the embattled directors, these sturdy men of the plains who had gambled fantastically, making it big when things went their way, now willing to put up small fortunes when things turned sour. They were Texas gamblers, and they did not whimper. "I like the way you're handling things," and he flew back to Fort Worth. But on the way east, he had a vision. You could term it nothing else. The action has got to swing to Dallas. With Houston in trouble on its real estate, and Midland in shock over oil, and the Rio Grande with up to 45% unemployed, leadership passes to Dallas. That's where the big fight for the soul of Texas is going to be conducted. That's where I want to be. So he directed his pilot to land not at Meacham Field, the city airport for Fort Worth, but at Love Field in Dallas. Radioing ahead for his driver to meet him at the new destination, He sped, immediately upon landing, toward that imposing complex of new construction in North Dallas, some 14 miles out from the traditional center of the city. And in one of the many rental offices peddling space in the bright new buildings, he rented what would become a major center of Dallas power, Ransom Rusk Enterprises. He had been in position only a few weeks when the wisdom of this move was proved, because as a major stockholder in Tex-Tech, he was summoned to their boardroom when that huge conglomerate stumbled into trouble. Pierre Soult, founding genius of the electronics end of the business, had died, throwing his pioneering but fragile company into such temporary disarray that the new management had to inform Rusk. Due to increased competition from Japan and an unforeseen collapse in electronic games and home computers, we've experienced a loss in the first quarter of $100 million and can expect a repeat or worse next quarter. When do we inform the public? Rusk asked as he calculated the effect on his huge holdings. Tomorrow. So Rusk was on hand when the devastating losses were announced to Wall Street, and he sat grim-lipped as the ticker reported the sensational drop in Tex-Tech. Within one trading day in New York, the paper value of Tex-Tech stock dropped by $1 billion. He was also on the scene as a major investor when Braniff Airlines, once the pride of Dallas, stumbled and fumbled, striving vainly to stay alive but missing every tenuous opportunity. In the panic meetings, he gave Braniff management counsel he had given his oil field managers in Odessa. Cut back. Decide ruthlessly what must be done, and do it now. He supervised the cutting away of the once profitable South American routes. He tried to halt the tremendous losses on the new routes the company had unwisely pioneered in recent months, and he did his best to find new funds. But in the end, he had to admit, "We gave it a good try. It's bankrupt." And Texas travelers through the massive new Dallas-Fort Worth airport looked shamefacedly at the vari-colored Braniff planes stowed aimlessly on the parking lots and tried to calculate the loss in money and pride which their clipped wings represented. One New York banking expert dispatched to Dallas to investigate the mood in Texas reported confidentially to his superiors, "People outside Texas, especially those in less favored states like Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, had begun to look upon Dallas and Houston as places where the figures could only go up. Now they are learning with the rest of us that they can also come down. Houston, Midland, Abilene, El Paso, Laredo, and the so-called Golden Triangle are disaster areas, and in certain hard-struck industries, unemployment reaches past 50%. Friends in the know advise me that Ransom Rusk, heavily involved in all the fields which have been hit, has suffered staggering losses. I have verified the following. His commanding position in Tex-Tech, loss $125 million. Sharp drop in the value of his oil holdings, loss $85 million. Bankruptcy of his mud company and idleness of his 19 drilling rigs, loss $35 million now, with more to come later. His position in Braniff Airlines, loss $45 million. Houston real estate reversal due to peso, loss $14 million. Collapse of the Midland Bank, loss maybe $21 million. Total Rusk loss in one calendar year, $325 million minimum. How did Rusk react to these losses, which were much greater than the visitor had estimated? He sat in his new office, surveyed the Dallas skyline with its multitude of soaring new construction, and said only to himself, "Now is when I dig in. I have more work to do than ever before." His shoulders did not slump, nor did he try to avoid inquisitors who wanted to ferret out the effect of these stupendous reversals. Instead, he showed his icy smile, stuck out his lower jaw, and predicted, "Every item in Texas will revive. The Mexican peso will stabilize. Oil will come back. We'll see the rigs operating again. Braniff will fly. We'll see to that. Tex-Tech has a dozen new inventions ready to astound the market. And the Dallas Cowboys will win the Super Bowl." "Then you're not pessimistic." "I don't know that word." When the bad years ended and his accountants showed him the final figures on his losses, he laughed and asked, "How many of your friends can say they lost nearly $500 million in 1 year?" And they said, "Not many." But even his aplomb was shaken by a series of those family tragedies which so often enmeshed the very rich in Texas. His famous father, Fat Floyd, had produced two daughters, Bertha and Linda, born almost a full generation before Ransom. Each had had four children, so that Ransom had eight nieces and nephews for whose fiscal welfare he was responsible. Just as his father had seen ownership of his first well split into minute fragments, so Ransom and the courts supervised the various allocations of ownership of the Rusk estate. Insofar as the offspring of Bertha and Linda were concerned, the pattern was this. Fat Floyd, 100%. Bertha, 16 2/3%. Three other children, 85%. Victor, 15%. Victor's children, Victoria, 11%. Four other children, 89%. Linda, 16 2/3%. Three other children, 89%. May, 11%. May's son Charles, 5%. Two other children, 95%. Ransom, 66 2/3%. To take only the case of the two fourth-generation children, Victoria and Charles, if one multiplied out the percentages, one found that Victoria owned 0.002750 of the Rusk estate, and Charles 0.000917. Since the estate, which participated only in the oil portion of Ransom's total holding, was now worth some $700 million, this meant that Victoria's share at an early age was worth $1,925,000, and Charles, $641,900. And since Ransom's adroit handling of the oil reserves produced a yearly income of about 16% on investments, young Victoria received some $308,000 each year, and Charles, $102,700. Various young Texans had comparable holdings. But these two, and their six siblings, were not enjoying their money these days, because their parents had become involved in shattering tragedies. May, of the third generation, had married a worthless young man who had angled for her shamefully, caught her, and then found himself unable to maintain pace with her lively interest in Texas life. He had escaped his deficiency by committing suicide. Victor, May's cousin and a most likable fellow, had fared little better. His wife, a beautiful girl but lacking in both character and will, had taken to the bottle early and with great vigor, deteriorating so totally that she had to be placed in an institution. It was one of the finest drying-out establishments in Texas, but it had an inadequate fire alarm system, and when an inebriated gentleman on the ground floor fell asleep while smoking a cigarette, the entire wing burst into flame, and only the heroic efforts of two Mexican caretakers saved Mrs. Rusk. She was horribly burned, but did survive. However, any chance of escaping her addiction to alcohol vanished, and both she and her family could look ahead only to her lifelong hospitalization. In this dual impasse, the cousins Victor and May started seeing each other, at first out of mutual commiseration, and eventually because of a deep and passionate love, despite the fact that they were cousins. When Victor felt that it would be shameful to divorce his stricken wife, he and May loaded the latter's Mercedes-Benz with cans of gasoline, roared down a Fort Worth freeway at 90 miles an hour, and plunged head-on into a concrete abutment. Ransom was left to answer the inquiries of the media and to care for his nieces and nephews, and the pitiful experiences resulting from these two obligations deepened his understanding. Summoning the children, he told them, "You've all known what was happening. You understand better than anyone else. So what's to do? Pull up your socks, grit your teeth, and take an oath. It's not going to happen to me." And as he spoke, he visualized those intrepid Rusks who had preceded them, and he began to see his ancestors in a kindlier light. His mother had been dowdy, but she had kept the family together when her husband was driving to locate an oil well. And Emma Larkin may have had no nose or ears, but he now realized that she'd had incredible fortitude. "Never forget," he continued, "that your great-grandmother Emma suffered far worse tragedies than you'll ever be required to face." And now he wanted to exorcise the guilt he felt for the ugly manner in which he had once dismissed his parents. "Don't forget that your ancestor, the one they called Fat Floyd, was willing to gamble his last penny on the oil well that got our family started. He had courage, and so must you." As he watched the effect of his words upon these young people, he thought, "This generation isn't going to be defeated." But then he realized that something more fundamental than fighting spirit was required to build a satisfactory life. So, with much embarrassment, he stood before them and said softly, "I love you very much. I will be here to help, no matter what happens. Let's stick together." Back in his new office, after the accountants had his family's affairs straightened out, he said, "Well, we can be sure of one thing. 1984 has to be better." And then his old fire returned. "Reagan'll be reelected, best president we've had in more than 60 years, but a mite long in the tooth. We'll eliminate more of those communists in the Senate, and we'll see oil bounce back. Maybe even Braniff will fly again." On the phone to Houston, he said cheerfully, "Good and bad, I'd rather be working in Texas than anywhere else in the world." Then, supremely confident that he would recover his lost dollars within 2 years, he flew to Kenya for a safari with his friends. If Ransom Rusk was finding new challenges in North Dallas, a small, sparkling, dark-eyed young woman of 25 named Enriqueta Musquiz was having an even more exciting adventure in South Dallas. Dallas consisted of 3 separate cities, really, and it was possible to live in any one and scarcely be aware of the other 2. There was downtown Dallas, the historic city on the Trinity River, which had boasted 2 log cabins in 1844, and not much more by 1860. An unpublished diary tells what happened in that year. On Sunday, the 8th of July, 1860, the citizens of this town awoke to find every store and rooming house ablaze. When the terrible conflagration was finally brought under control, a jury of 52 leading citizens was impaneled, and upon their finding that the fire must surely have been part of a slave plot, 3 Negroes were promptly hanged. Despite its slow start, downtown Dallas had prospered, and now contained the business heart of a metropolis with more than 1 million inhabitants, and of a metropolitan area with more than 3 million. North Dallas, where Rusk had his new office, was a golden ghetto of palatial homes, resplendent new skyscrapers, luxurious shopping centers, and a way of life that was, said one critic, both appealing and appalling. It was appealing because it provided what its inhabitants wanted. It was appalling because of its brazen flaunting of wealth. But the true secret of North Dallas was that it was a world to itself. Residents could live there quite happily and rarely bother about venturing into the clutter of central Dallas. Boasted the average North Dallas housewife, "I go into that maelstrom only when there's a meeting of the Art Museum Board." And almost no one from North Dallas ever crossed the Trinity River to enter South Dallas, where blacks and Hispanics lived. And rarely did anyone from central Dallas go there. It was a city to itself, impoverished, poorly cared for, and constantly embattled with its wealthier neighbors to the north. Those residents of northern states who had imbibed from television and newspapers the illusion that Texas, and Dallas in particular, was populated only by millionaires, received a shock if they ventured into South Dallas. There were many reasons for the impoverishment of this area. Texas, perhaps the wealthiest of the states, was among the most niggardly in its services for the poor, and in certain criteria like unemployment benefits, it stood at the bottom of the 50 states. It was not good to be a poor person in Texas, and downright miserable to be one in South Dallas. But this was where Enriqueta Musquiz was having her exhilarating experience. Following that February afternoon in 1969, when she leaped aboard the Southern Pacific freight train in El Paso, she spent her first years in Texas in Lubbock, where she had suffered the full force of West Texas discrimination, which in many ways was worse than anything known along the Rio Grande, since the northern region held so few Hispanics and disregarded them with such insolence. "When I was young," she told her fourth-grade pupils, "no Hispanic was allowed in the better restaurants, and we were not welcomed in the movie theaters. We were expected to quit school at the eighth grade. Boys could not get haircuts in the regular barbershops, and we were held in contempt." When she gave such lectures, which she did repeatedly and to all her classes, she invariably ended with a refrain which summarized the major triumph of her life. In 1974, the Supreme Court of the United States handed down a decision called Lau versus Nichols, which you must remember because it is your Declaration of Independence. It did not deal directly with us, but with a Chinese boy named Lau, and it said, "Even if he is Chinese, and even if he cannot speak a word of English, the United States of America must provide him with an education, and, since he cannot speak English, this education must be in Chinese." Don't you see? The Supreme Court is saying the same to you children. If you cannot speak English, you must be educated in Spanish, and that's why I'm here. Señorita Musquiz, as she wanted her students to call her, even though she, along with her father and two brothers, had attained United States citizenship, spoke to her 30 children in grade 4 and her 33 in grade 3 only in Spanish. And in this language, which she was supposed to use only temporarily as a bridge to English, she spent about half her time haranguing them about the injustices of American life, with special emphasis on the inequities they suffered in Dallas. She did this because she visualized herself as an agency of revenge for all the suffering she and her people had undergone in West Texas. And as she labored to create in her students a burning appreciation of their Spanish heritage and the glories of Mexican culture, she foresaw the day when the Spanish-speaking people along the Rio Grande, south and north, would form a kind of ipso facto republic, half Mexican, half American, in which pesos and dollars would both be used. A common currency and a common outlook on life would prevail, and a common language, Spanish, would be spoken. Of course, it will be an advantage if you have English as a second language, to work in stores and such, but the effective language will be Spanish, and the mode of life will be Mexican, with large families closely bound together, and with priests who give their sermons in Spanish. "What citizenship will we have?" her older children sometimes asked, and she said, "It really won't matter, because Mexico will not rule the area, nor will the United States. It will be a union of the two, with free passage across the river." "How big will it be?" the children asked. And on the map of Mexico that she kept in her room, a map in Spanish, so cut across at the top that it included Texas as far north as Lubbock, she used her pointer to indicate a swath which encompassed San Antonio, San Angelo, and El Paso on the north, and Monterrey, Saltillo, and Chihuahua on the south. "The new nation of our dreams already exists. Spanish is spoken up here, and English is understood down there. Trade between the two halves is already flowing and will grow as years pass. Brownsville and Matamoros at the eastern end of the river, who can tell which is which? Will the nation reach all the way to California?" a child asked one day, and she said, "It already does." But another child said, "Señorita Musquiz, I grew up in San Angelo, and they don't speak much Spanish there." And she said, "They will, when enough of us come north and fill the places." Her dream was not an idle one. There were many living along that protracted border who were already affecting the change which she promulgated with her students during the day and with her adult friends at night. Experts, and even those with only a casual interest, could see that the unstoppable flow of Mexican nationals into the United States must inevitably create a new society, with new attitudes, and perhaps new political affiliations. Señorita Musquiz's early appreciation of this fact was intensified when in the summer of 1982 she enrolled in a special seminar in Los Angeles, and when she returned, she carried exciting news to her Texas friends. Los Angeles is already the second largest Spanish-speaking city in the world, larger even than Madrid, smaller only than Mexico City. The food, the culture, the manner of thought are totally Mexican, and our newspaper, La Opinión, prints 60,000 copies a day. More than 10 theaters show movies only in Spanish, and the schools are filled with dedicated teachers like me, keeping our beautiful language alive and reminding our children of their Mexican heritage. What is happening is simple in process, glorious in effect. We are quietly reclaiming the land which Santa Anna lost through his insane vanity. Vast areas which are rightfully Mexican are coming back to us. No battles, no gunfire, no animosities, simply the inexorable movement of people north. The Anglos still control the banks, the newspapers, the courts, but we have the power which always triumphs in the end, the power of people. Proof of her contention came dramatically when immigration agents raided a big ranch south of Dallas and arrested some 20 illegal immigrants who had evaded the border patrol. From Dallas came a general cry of approval. But when officials looked more deeply into the matter, they found that Lorenzo Quimper, owner of the ranch, had arranged for his traveling factotum, Candido Guzman, to obtain citizenship. And Candido, in turn, had imported from his small hometown of Moctezuma 6 young nephews, who he claimed had proof of having been born in that hospital in El Paso. So, instead of having nearly 24 wetbacks to deport, the agents had fewer than 15, and the affair caused much amusement in Dallas. Señorita Musquiz jumped on this unfortunate affair as a major topic for her two classes to analyze. And with her careful guidance, the young Hispanics learned of the government's brutality and of the heroism of the Mexicans, legal or otherwise, who had worked their way so far north without having been detected. They are the heroes of our conquest, and like my father, they will stay. Studiously, she avoided uttering the word revolución, and even when she voiced it silently to herself, she always followed it with pacífico. She did not visualize gunfire or rebellion, because there was no need. Everything she desired was attainable through slow but persistent penetration. For the present, she did not include Texas cities as far north as Dallas in her looming Confederacy. At least, not for the remainder of this century. The Anglos are too strong. But I can see it happening sometime after 2030. When she assured personal friends that it must happen, she called it the inevitable triumph of the marriage bed. Mexican women have many children. Anglos don't. In her general activity, Señorita Musquiz conducted herself with strict legality, but without advising her superiors, she operated against the rules as they were intended. The Supreme Court decision, Lau versus Nichols, and the subsequent orders which implemented it, known as Lau Relief, had as their purpose the education of very young children in America, whether citizens or not, in their native tongue, so that an easier transition into English could be made. Thus, certain large cities throughout the nation, and many with no Spanish-speaking minority at all, were required to teach elementary school classes in many different tongues. And to accomplish this, they had to find qualified young persons who could teach arithmetic, geography, music, and science in Chinese, Portuguese, French, Russian, Polish, and some 50 other languages. As a consequence, the teaching of Chinese flourished, but that of science and arithmetic did not, for there were few of the hastily enlisted teachers who had the solid competence in their subject areas that Señorita Musquiz had in hers. "She is one of the best teachers in Dallas," her supervisor said. "Her only fault is that she is slow in getting her pupils to switch over into English." This tardiness was not accidental, for after these new teachers of Spanish had been on the job only a little while, they promoted the theory called maintenance, which meant that even after their pupils had reached a stage at which they could switch over to English, instruction in Spanish continued, on the principle that the mastery of a second language was so valuable to the United States that proficiency in that language became a goal in itself. Thus, Señorita Musquiz's students came to school at age 6, knowing almost no English. And at 7 or 8, they were supposed to swing over to the English-speaking classes. But under the new theory of maintenance, they were kept in Spanish right through elementary school, until learning in Spanish, with inadequate mastery of subject matter, became the rule. And in Spanish, they learned from certain teachers, like the señorita, that they were an oppressed group, discriminated against, and obligated to lead the great social changes which would transform their portion of America into a reclaimed Mexican homeland. Señorita Musquiz did not have clear sailing in her program, for SMU had a charismatic professor of history who had worked for 5 years in the Peace Corps in various South American countries, and he had come home with a few hard-won conclusions about life in that world. His name was Roy Aspen, University of Texas, Stanford, University of Hawaii, 37 years old, and iron tough. He first attracted Señorita Musquiz's attention in 1983 when he gave a widely discussed lecture, The Error of Bilingualism, in which he pointed out with scholarly precision the dangers inherent in establishing, even accidentally, a two-language nation. Had he kept to the main point, his lecture might have gone unnoticed. But at the end, he added two unfortunate paragraphs, which aroused unnecessary antagonism. A major corollary to this problem can be expressed in a question which we consistently avoid. Why did those parts of the Western Hemisphere which fell under Spanish control fail to develop rational systems of self-government? And why did those regions falling under English control succeed? The facts are overwhelming. No American nation deriving from a Spanish heritage, except possibly Costa Rica, has learned to govern itself in an orderly and just manner. Those with a different heritage have. Now, you may not want to admit that the non-Spanish nations have achieved responsible government and a just distribution of wealth, while the Spanish-speaking nations never have, but those are the facts. So to encourage a bilingualism which might bring into Texas the corrupt governmental systems of our neighbors to the south would be folly, if not suicide. When she left the lecture hall, Señorita Musquiz was trembling, and to the fellow Hispanics she met that night she said, "We must declare war on this racist pig. He is reviving the black legend that was discredited a century ago." And she drafted a letter to the editor, which surprised readers with its daring argument. "I am sick and tired of hearing that Spanish-speaking nations cannot govern themselves. Since Lázaro Cárdenas was elected president of Mexico in 1934, our well-governed nation to the south has had an unbroken sequence of brilliant leaders, each of whom has served his full 6 years without incident. In that same period, the United States has had Roosevelt die in office, Truman, Ford, and Reagan attacked by would-be assassins, Kennedy murdered, Nixon expelled, and Johnson, Ford, and Carter denied re-election. Mexico is the stable, well-governed nation. The United States terrifies its neighbors by its reactionary irresponsibility. And as for the vaunted American system of distributing income fairly, we who live in South Dallas see precious little of either generosity or reward." Her assault was so bold, and her data so relevant, that she was encouraged by her Hispanic friends to keep fighting. And when Dr. Aspen ended the session with the acerbic comment that Señorita Musquiz should remember that a return passage to Mexico was always easier than an infiltration of our border, her infuriated sympathizers urged her to initiate what developed into the notorious Musquiz-Aspen debates of 1984. They focused on bilingual education and generated intense partisanship. The protagonists were evenly matched. This dedicated, attractive young woman of Mexican derivation, opposing an able professor of Swedish heritage who knew the Latin countries better than she. Each spoke from the most sincere conviction, and neither was reluctant to lunge for the jugular. She made 2 points which gave thoughtful Texans something to chew on, and she did so with enough insolence to command attention and enough validity to command respect. Let's look at this Anglo charge of cultural impoverishment in Mexico. Where in the United States is there a museum one-tenth as glorious as the new archaeological one in Mexico City? It celebrates with explosive joy the glories of Mexico. And where can I go in the United States to see the grandeur of your Indian heritage? Are you ashamed of your history? Don't tell me about the Metropolitan Museum in New York or the Mellon in Washington. They're fine buildings, but they're filled with the work of Europeans, not Americans. Impoverished intellectually, who is impoverished? Her second bit of evidence received wide circulation and verification from various social agencies. If you check with social services here in Dallas, you will find that they carry on their books 316 otherwise responsible Anglo men who ignore court orders directing them to help support children whom they have abandoned, while your post office reports that Mexican workers in this metropolitan area, poorest of the poor and under no compulsion other than human decency, send home to their families south of the border more than $400,000 monthly. Which society is more civilized? Dr. Aspen, realizing that he could not best Senorita Musquiz in the disorderly brawling at which she excelled, sought to bring the debate to a higher level by convincing SMU to organize a powerfully staffed symposium entitled Bicultural Education, Fiction and Fact. From the moment the brochures were printed, everyone could see that this was going to be an explosive affair, and experts from many states crowded into SMU, filling the university dormitories and occasionally standing at the rear of conference halls in which every seat was taken. The United States as a whole had a profound interest in this subject, and national newspapers carried summaries of the opening address, in which a United States senator said, "I voted for the legislation which spurred the initiation of bilingual education, and of course I applauded the Supreme Court decision of Lau versus Nichols. I did so because I believed that all young people in this country, whether citizens or not, deserved the best education possible, the soundest introduction to our system of values. I now realize that I made a dreadful mistake and that the Supreme Court decision, Lau versus Nichols, is one of the worst it has made in 100 years. Together, we have invited our beloved nation to stagger down a road which will ultimately lead to separatism, animosity, and the deprivation of the very children we sought to help. I hereby call for the revocation of the system we so erroneously installed and the abolishment of the legislation sponsoring it." There was an outcry from the floor, and a man from Arizona who supported Senorita Musquiz's theories demanded the podium for an immediate rebuttal. But with a calm which infuriated, Professor Aspen ignored the clamor and called for the second speaker, an elderly Jewish professor from Oregon, who gave a most thoughtful analysis of past American experience. "I will be forgiven, I hope, if I draw upon my family's experience. But my grandfather came to New York in 1903 from the Galician region of what was then Austria, but which had through most of history been Poland. He landed knowing not a word of English, and when, in 1906, he was able to send to Galicia for the rest of his family, his wife and three children, including my father, landed at Ellis Island, again with no English. My grandfather spoke abominable English. My grandmother never learned. But the three children were thrown into the American school system, and within 4 months were jabbering away. Both my father and my Aunt Elzbieta were writing their homework in English by the end of that first year, and both graduated from grade school with honors. That was the grand tradition which produced a melting pot from which poured an unending stream of Italian, German, Polish, Slavic, and Jewish young people, prepared to grapple on equal terms with the best that Harvard, Yale, and Chicago were producing. In fact, my father went to Yale, and others from the various ghettos went to Stanford and Michigan and North Carolina. To change a system which has worked so well and with such honorable results is a grave error, and one which, having been made, requires immediate reversal." Again, there was an outcry from those whose careers had been enhanced by the introduction of bilingualism. But once again, Professor Aspen ignored the hullabaloo, taking the podium himself to speak of his experiences. If one looks at the linguistic tragedy that impends in Canada, where French speakers want to fracture the nation in defense of their language, or in Belgium, where French speakers fight with Walloons who speak Flemish, or in the Isle of Cyprus, where Turk and Greek quarrel over languages, or in South Africa, where a nation is rent by language differences, or in India, where thousands are slain in language riots, or anywhere else where language is a divisive force, one can only weep for the antagonisms thus inherited. These countries bear a terrible burden, the lack of a common tongue, and more fortunate nations ought to sympathize with them and give them assistance in seeking solutions to what appear to be insoluble problems. Charity is obligatory. But for a nation like the United States, which has a workable central tongue used by many countries around the world, consciously to introduce a linguistic separatism and to encourage it by the expenditure of public funds, is to create and encourage a danger which could in time destroy this nation, as the others I spoke of may one day be destroyed. India inherited its linguistic jungle. It did not create it willfully. History gave South Africa its divisive bilingualism. It did not seek it. Such nations are stuck with what accident and history gave them, and they cannot justly be accused of having made foolish error. But if the United States consciously invents a linguistic dualism, it deserves the castigation of history. Let us focus on the main problem. If we continue to educate our Spanish-speaking immigrants and native-born in Spanish for the first 6 years of their education, and if we teach the vital subjects of literature and history in that language, we will see, before the end of this century, exactly the kind of separatism which now plagues Canada. But our example will be much worse than theirs, because our sample of the disaffected will be larger and will have on its southern border a nation, a Central America, and an entire continent speaking that language and sponsoring that separatism. Let us face these ominous facts and see what we can do to counteract and forestall them. At the close of his address, reporters immediately crowded about Aspin. "Do you oppose Miss Muskies personally?" And he replied amiably, "Not at all. She serves a most useful purpose in providing Mexican immigrants with leadership. Texas profits from its Mexican workers, and they're entitled to her guidance. But when her ideas are so erroneous that they might lead our entire nation into irreversible error, they must be corrected." What did you think of her statement that, if history had been just, Los Angeles and Houston would now be Mexican cities? He considered this for a moment. Interesting speculation. The cities might be Mexican, but they would not be Los Angeles and Houston. Under traditional Mexican mismanagement, they'd be more like Guaymas and Tampico. When Senorita Muskies gained the floor to counteract the strong points made by Professor Aspin, she controlled her seething fury and gave one of the better presentations of the symposium. She denied that teachers like her kept their students imprisoned in Spanish when they must lead their adult lives in English. She denied that she ever taught Mexican imperialism. She denied that the Supreme Court case infringed in any way on American rights. Since she really believed that she acted only in the best interest of her pupils, she had no hesitancy in denying that she, or teachers like her, kept their students from learning English. Then, in sober terms, she reminded her audience of the grave disadvantages Mexican immigrants had suffered in Texas, the cruel way in which their culture had been abused, the remorseless way they had been handled by rangers along the border, and the thoughtless contempt with which they were so often treated. "We have lived side by side with the North Americans since 1810, and we have made every concession to their superior power. They had the votes, the guns, the law courts, and the banks on their side, and we bowed low in the gutters and allowed them to usurp the sidewalks. But when they now demand that we surrender our language and our patterns of life, we say no." She gave a stirring defense of bicultural life, which she refrained from equating with bilingual education paid for by the host state. And in the end, in a peroration that brought tears to some, she shared her vision of a de facto state along the border, from Brownsville to San Diego, in which the two cultures, the two economic systems, and the two languages would exist in a mixed harmony. As the symposium wound to a close, argument over the Simpson-Mazzoli bill erupted, shattering her carefully nurtured impression of reasonableness. Simpson-Mazzoli was an effort by a Republican senator and a Democratic representative to staunch the hemorrhaging along the Mexican border and to bring order among the estimated 10 million illegal immigrants who had drifted north and who existed in a kind of judicial no-man's land. The bill offered three solutions. Halt further illegal entry. Grant generous amnesty to those well-intentioned and well-behaved Mexicans already here, and penalize American employers who hired illegals. It was a good bill, basically, but Hispanic leaders like Senorita Musquiz opposed it vehemently on the dubious grounds that it would require immigrants like her, who had later obtained legal status, to carry identification cards. "Am I to wear a yellow star like Hitler's Jews?" she shouted. "Must I carry proof that I'm a legal resident? What Anglo employer will run the risk of hiring me when he can hire a fellow Anglo with no danger of breaking the law?" Professor Aspen dismissed such reasoning with one compelling question. Can a sovereign democracy control its borders, or can't it? Without waiting for an answer, he added, "The incessant flow of illegals from Mexico and Central America must be halted, or the United States will be engulfed by hordes of uneducated persons who will try to convert it into just another Hispanic dictatorship." Senorita Musquiz opposed the bill for defensible reasons, but there were other Hispanic leaders who fought it for personal gain. They wanted either an assured supply of cheap labor or a constant inflow of potential voters to bolster Hispanic claims. To all opponents of the bill, Dr. Aspen asked, "Are you recommending a completely open border across which anyone in Mexico can come as he or she wishes?" And the senorita replied, "You'd better keep the border open, because Texas and California prosper only because of the profit they make on this guaranteed supply of cheap labor. Stop the flow, and Texas will collapse in depression." A television newsman, overhearing the argument, asked her, "But if the Mexicans and Central Americans keep pressing in, won't this mean that eventually most of Texas will become Mexican?" And she said, looking defiantly into the camera, "If Hispanic mothers in Central America have many babies and Anglo mothers in Texas have few, I suppose there will have to be an irresistible sweep of immigrants to the north. Yes, Texas will become Spanish." And even as she spoke, the American Congress, debating in Washington, refused to pass the reasonable Simpson-Mazzoli bill, thus destroying any attempt by the United States to control the influx of illegals across its borders. For the most venal reasons, the citizens of Texas were in the forefront of this cynical rejection of common sense. They were willing to accept immediate profits while ignoring future consequences. As a result, the immigration authorities along the Rio Grande stopped trying to stem the unceasing inflow of illegals, turning their attention rather to keeping them out of the larger cities like Dallas and Amarillo. The creation of the ipso facto Mexican-American nation along the Rio Grande was underway. So the embittered Musquiz-Aspen debates ended with a rousing victory for the señorita, and the well-intentioned peasants from Mexico, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and El Salvador, yearning for freedom and a decent life, continued to stream across the Rio Grande. When Senorita Musquiz heard on the evening news that Simpson-Mazzoli was dead, she cried in Spanish to those who were listening with her, "Hooray! We'll win back every bit of land Santa Ana gave away, and we won't have to fire one shot." Professor Aspen, when he heard the same news, told his students, "Before the end of this century, Texas will start contemplating her privilege of breaking into smaller states. There'll be a movement to create along the Rio Grande a Hispanic state." "Are you serious?" they asked. "Doesn't matter whether I am or not. The unquenchable flood of immigration will determine it." Sociologists called them rites of passage, and this theory enabled them to predict certain inevitables which had to occur in any society, no matter how primitive or advanced. At age two, babies would begin to assert their own personalities, often with reverberations that altered family relationships. At 15, young males would begin to concentrate on girls, who had been concentrating on boys since 13, and at about 27, men would begin thinking about challenging the older leaders of the tribe, with similar inevitables trailing a man to his grave. In Houston, comparable rules dictated behavior. Among society's more fortunate few, men in their early 30s like Roy Bub Hooker, Todd Morrison, and their two friends, the oil man and the dentist, would want to find themselves a quail lease somewhere to the south along the borders of the Great King Ranch. In their late 30s, they'd want an airplane to fly them quickly to their preserve. In their early 40s, they'd begin to do what all sensible Texans did, aspire to take their vacations, summer or winter, in Colorado. And in their late 40s, sure as thunder after a lightning stab, they'd want to find themselves a ranch in that glorious hill country west of Austin. And when this happy day occurred, they would almost certainly switch to the Republican Party. On schedule, these urges hit the four members of Roy Bubb's hunting team, with results that could have been anticipated. In their occupations, the men had prospered unevenly, with the oil man finding headline success, and Todd Morrison, once of Detroit, approaching the well-to-do category of a real estate millionaire with close to $20 million. But the dentist was mired in the lower levels, with only $1 or $2 million, and Roy Bubb still dug sewers with no millions at all. So Morrison and the oil man bought the plane, a four-seater Beechcraft. But it was Roy Bubb who learned to fly it. And for three memorable years, they flew almost each weekend during hunting season, and at least twice a month thereafter, down to Falforius to their lease, which was now a minor Shangri-La. But they had not been doing this for long when the greatest of the Houston urges trapped them, and they began to think about purchasing a ranch west of Austin. In Houston, a young man of ambition and talent was allowed so much elbow room that he could progress pretty much at his own speed. But if he passed into his 40s without owning a ranch, he betrayed himself as one who had left the fast track to find refuge in mediocre success along the more relaxed detours. Although Morrison and the oil man had the money, they still looked to Roy Bubb as the outdoor expert, so that when they started searching seriously for their ranch, they placed in his hands the responsibility for finding it. Often in the late 1970s, Roy Bubb and one or two of the others would fly out for scouting trips through the lovely hills and valleys beyond the Balcones Fault. Few visitors from the north ever saw this wonderland of central Texas, this marvelously rich congregation of small streams winding down valleys, of sudden meadowlands encompassed by hills, of 100 acres of bluebonnets in the spring, and of the probing fingers of the man-made lakes, creeping deep into the rolling corners of the land. To see it from the highways that wandered through was delectable, but to see it as the four hunters now did, from low altitude in their plane, was a privilege of which they never tired. This was the golden heart of Texas, and a man was entitled to a share after he had brought in his third oil well or built his fourth skyscraper. It was Roy Bubb who first spotted their dreamland. He had flown west from Austin and was keeping to the south shore of the huge lake, which had appeared one day among the hills, when he saw a small feeder river winding here and there, aimlessly and with many bends, as if reluctant to lose its identity in the larger body of water. He told Morrison, who had accompanied him this time, "That's got to be the Pedernales." And he pronounced the name as Texans did, "Pedernales." As he followed the little stream westward, he suddenly twisted the Beechcraft about, doubled back, and shouted, "There it is!" They were over the magnificent ranch put together by Lyndon Johnson, and for some minutes they circled this Texas monument to a prototypical Texas man. Morrison, looking down at the airstrip built with federal taxes, the roadways paved by the state, the fences built by friends, and the pastures stocked by other friends, thought, "Who really cares if he was a Wheeler dealer? He was a damned good president, and one day this'll all seep back to public ownership. I'd like to be president for just one term." And then, after they passed the Johnson Ranch, Rybob saw it, a stretch of handsome land on the north bank of the Pedernales. It contained everything the four hunters sought. A long stretch fronting the river, good ground cover for grouse and turkey, ample trees for deer to browse, plus a kind of park along the river, and bleak empty spaces for wildlife to roam. It was the original Ollerkamp ranch of 5,000 acres, to which had been added the McNabb holdings of equal size. And when Rybob landed his plane at Fredericksburg, he and Morrison discovered to their delight that it was for sale. Once they satisfied themselves that it suited their purposes, neither man ever turned back. Rybob assuring his partners that it was the best available ranch in Texas, and Morrison convincing the oil man that it was a bargain, regardless of what the German owners wanted. And a deal was struck, with Todd and the oil man putting up most of the money, and Rybob and the dentist doing most of the work. On a sad November Friday in 1980, they flew down to Falfurrias to inform the owner of their present lease that they would be terminating it on March 1st, and he was genuinely unhappy to see them go. "You lived up to every promise you ever made. I'll miss you." The oil man said, "Now, if this causes you to lose any money..." But he interrupted, "I'll be able to arrange a new lease by tomorrow noon. Must be 200 young tigers in Houston panting for a lease like this." On one point, the old contract was clear. Any building which they had erected belonged to him, if it was fastened to the ground. Any that remained movable belonged to them. And Rybob surprised the owner by saying, "We'll want to take all the buildings with us." "Well, they're yours. But I was hoping you'd want to sell them at an attractive price. Save you a lot of trouble." But Rybob said, "No, we can use them at the new place." And the owner looked in amazement as the oil man moved in three of his crews, who sawed the six small houses apart, mounted them on great trucks, and headed them 241 miles northwest to their new home, where they would be reassembled to form an attractive hunting lodge in a far corner of the Ollerkamp land. The four hunters and their families had occupied the new ranch only 2 years when once more the inevitable pressures exerted by the rites of passage attacked them. The dentist discovered that he was now strong enough financially to abandon his practice and devote himself full-time to the propagation and sale of his hunting dogs. He withdrew from the consortium and opened a master kennel on the outskirts of Houston. At the same time, the oil man was struck by an insidious disease which affected many Texas oil men. "All my life I've dreamed of shooting in England and Scotland, the moors, the hunt breakfasts with kippers under the silver covers, the faithful gillies, the long weekends. Gentlemen, I've leased a stretch of good salmon river near Inverness, and you're invited to come over in season." His Scottish adventure so absorbed him, what with the purchase of another Purdy gun and the making of arrangements for his Highland headquarters, that one night he informed Morrison and Rybob that he wanted to sell off his portion of the Ollerkamp ranch. But when Todd said, almost eagerly, "I think I could swing it," he surprised both men by saying, "I'd want to cut Rybob in. Let's get him a grubstake." And he persisted in this decision, arranging for Hooker a long-term payment with no interest. "I owe it to you, Rybob. You taught me what the outdoors was." 6 months later, the Houston social pages displayed photographs of the oil man at his lodge in the Scottish Highlands, where he had been entertaining a British executive of Shell Oil, a Lord Duncraven, and a financier involved with the big oil operation in the North Sea, a Sir Hilary Cobham. It was an engaging shot, with the Houston man looking more like a Scottish laird than the locals. So now, Todd Morrison and Rybob Hooker owned a ranch on the Pedernales and half a Beechcraft airplane. But the latter awkwardness was resolved when the oil man, totally preoccupied with his holdings in Scotland, offered to sell his part of the plane at a tremendous bargain, which Todd and Rybob gladly accepted. When the deal was closed with this remarkably generous old friend, they saw him no more. He had leaped 5 steps up the social ladder. But Morrison was generating enough income from his manifold real estate deals to permit him to absorb most of the cost of the ranch. and after an airstrip had been installed, well away from the river, the private planes of many Houston real estate managers appeared at Otterkamp, and the place became known as a site where developers and their wives could enjoy a good time. Despite this concentration on business, and Morrison was never far removed from a deal of some kind, his love for the land never diminished, and he was therefore in a receptive mood when Roy Bubb came to him one weekend with a challenging proposition. "Old buddy, I think we got ourselves a gold mine here. My recommendation, we fence it in." "It's already fenced in. I mean game-proof fence." These were startling words, and Todd remained silent for some time, simply staring at the driller of septic tanks. Finally he asked, very slowly, "You mean those fences 8.5 feet high?" And before Roy Bubb could respond, he asked, "You thinking of exotics?" Then Roy Bubb said, "I sure am. Todd, with your money and my management and my feel for animals, we could have us a ball on this ranch." "Do you know what game-proof fencing costs?" "I do." And from his wallet, he produced a study of costs. "Very best, guaranteed to hold everything but an armadillo, around $9,000 a mile." Rapidly, Todd analyzed their situation. 10,000 acres, divide by 640 acres to the mile, that's about 16 square miles. If it was a perfect square, which it isn't, that'd be a perimeter of 16 miles we'd have to fence. But we'd need cross-fencing to break it into pastures, so add 8 miles. 24 miles of fencing at 9,000 a mile. Jesus, Roy Bubb, that's 216,000 just for the fences, without the stock, which doesn't come cheap. Todd, I got me a lead on some of the best exotics in the United States. Everybody wants to deal with me. The basic stock I can pick up for $130,000, believe me. They sat in the evening darkness reviewing these notes, and when Carlene and Maggie came in to see if they wanted drinks, the men asked their wives to stay. "The land isn't square," Todd explained, "so the fencing might be even more than we've calculated. But I'll bet I can get us a lot better bargain than 9,000 a mile," Roy Bubb said. "What do you ladies think?" Todd asked. And Maggie responded quickly. "I believe we could swing it, so long as real estate stays up." And Carlene said, "Roy Bubb's always liked animals. I suppose we'd want to move up here to get things organized." And Roy Bubb said, "We sure would."